he's Irish, so he loves telling stories. So I thought, well, so I said, yes, that's right. And I could remember my father loved telling stories too, and I think his relatives probably did, so maybe I picked that up. But that's a kind of identity which I have no objection to. It's used in a purely descriptive way, because he was like that. He, you know, you would expect him not to speak French. When I went to Princeton as an undergraduate, I took philosophy in my first year, simply because it was something my parents had talked about a certain amount at home, and I thought it might be a subject I'd be interested in, although I didn't have much of an idea what it was. So the first semester it was a course in Plato, and the second semester one of those traditional Descartes to Kant courses, and I liked them. I liked it quite well, although I found it not easy. I thought I'd go into mathematics, but for various reasons having to do with bad choices about what courses to take and so on, I found myself in a kind of dead end. So at the end of my second year, when I had to make a choice, I signed up for philosophy. And it was all right, but the second semester of my third year, I took a seminar on philosophy of mathematics from a man named Paul Benacerraf, who had just finished a dissertation in that subject, which was quite a brilliant dissertation. He is a very judgmental character, very firm and sharp. I don't know if you know him, but very enthusiastic and intense about the subject, and a very, very good teacher. Anyway, so I loved this class, and decided that the next year, when I had to write a senior thesis, that was a requirement to graduate from that university, that I would write one on philosophy of mathematics with Benacerraf. I was interested in the question of the existence of mathematical objects. It's a funny thing about ontology. I don't know whether you feel that ontology, this, the most abstract subject, the question of what exists, excites particular passion. And in many people, it excites a kind of negative passion. That is, many people are ontological minimalists of a certain sort. It seems to be true, in particular, in Australia, not wanting to countenance. So, but my passion was on the opposite side. That is, when I read a paper by Willard Quine and Nelson Goodman on abstract objects, they were denouncing the idea that sets or any other kind of abstract objects could exist. It was a defense of nominalism. And this made me actually quite angry. I mean, I was passionate about wanting to say that, no, it's a mistake to think that. And so I wrote my senior thesis on these questions of mathematical ontology with Benacerraf as my supervisor. And in the course of that year in working on this project, I got into it much more deeply than I'd ever been involved in any intellectual enterprise. And in the middle of the year, Benacerraf said to me when I went to talk to him about something that I really should apply to graduate school. And it never occurred to me to go to graduate school in philosophy. I always thought that I would go back to Indiana and practice law with my father. It's the only thing I'd ever thought of doing. But Paul was very insistent. And I was flattered, but I was frightened, because it was a strange idea. It wasn't just philosophy, but it was the whole idea of an academic life, which I had no idea what it would be like. But I applied, and by the end of the year, I very much wanted to do it, but I didn't have the courage to do it. So I sent in my deposit to go to law school. But at the last minute, I got a fellowship to go to Oxford. While I was in Oxford, I decided that I just couldn't give up philosophy, and so I then came back to Harvard and studied philosophy. Right back in Harvard, it was as it still is now, a rather small department, but very distinguished department. The leading members of the department were Quine and Rawls, also a man named Roderick Firth, who was a well-known epistemologist. Rogers Allbritton was an extremely charismatic and brilliant, one of these people who never published much of anything, but had enormous impact through the power of his mind and his personality. Stanley Cavell had just come back and rejoined the department. I'm probably leaving somebody else, but they were the most influential ones. And there was also a man named Burton Drebin, who was a taught logic and also worked with Quine, and also was a very, strongly negative Wittgensteinian. He was one of the people, followers of late Wittgenstein, who thought that it showed that philosophy really couldn't go anywhere. But I wound up writing a dissertation with Drebin, because I wanted to write a dissertation on logic, and he was the person who, only person in that department who was doing serious logic. Hilary Putnam joined the department just the last year before I was leaving, but I was already well into my dissertation at that point. So I worked with Drebin, and he was very kind and supportive to me, but I let his philosophical views just kind of wash over me. I didn't pay attention to them, but I just worked with him on logic. And I also worked with Rawls, but I didn't, it wasn't my, wasn't what I was really working on in my dissertation. I got to know him quite well. I should tell another little bit of the story, which is sort of amusing. That is, when I was a senior at Princeton, going into my senior year, I'd never taken any courses in moral and political philosophy. I was sort of as my colleague and friend at Princeton, Richard Jeffrey, said, a teenaged logical positivist. But I was told at the beginning of my senior year that if I wanted to pass the honors exams at the end of the year, I should take at least two courses in moral or political philosophy. So I took the courses. And the first course I took was taught by a man named Howard Sobel, who had just gotten his PhD from Michigan. And he was mainly interested in kind of game theory and that sort of approaches to moral philosophy. And also, the course was about half of that and half 1950s metaethics, R.M. Hare and Stevenson and Moore and that sort of thing. So I found this, to my surprise, I found this extremely interesting, particularly the sort of quasi-game theoretic or social choice kind of. So when I went to Oxford, I was spending a lot of time studying that kind of thing, reading Little's Critique of Welfare Economics and Luce and Rafe's text on game theory, things like that. But I was finding it rather frustrating. I thought, even then, looking back, I don't think I'm just reading this into the past, but I found it frustrating because it was sort of preferences in, conclusions out. And it seemed to me, and although I loved the techniques, I was very mathematically inclined. It was not difficult, it was interesting. I liked the proof of Arrow's theorem and all those things, it was very elegant. But I didn't feel it was very satisfying. And in January of that year, this was January of 1963. I went there, I graduated in the fall of 62, and I went there in autumn of 62. I graduated in June of 62 and went to Oxford in the fall. But in January, I was down in the basement in a very cold January, everything was frozen. I was down in the basement of Blackwell's looking at the used books to spend my book allowance that went with my fellowship. And I saw on the shelf a book with a black book that said on the spine in red and white letters, The Moral Law, H.J. Payton. And I thought, that's a book I've often seen in philosophy libraries. I should have a look and see if I want to buy it. I pulled it down. It opened up. It was Kant's Groundwork. I didn't even know that Kant had written anything on moral philosophy. So I thought, well, I should probably read this. So I bought it for £1.50. It was a used book. And I went back to my room, and I started reading it. And I found it baffling but fascinating. So I spent most of the next 2 months reading two books and making copious notes on the book, trying to understand them. One was Kant's Groundwork, and the other was a very thick book, a textbook in proof theory called Introduction to Metamathematics by Stephen C. Kleene, referred to by my teacher in logic at Princeton, Raymond Smullyan, as that Baroque monstrosity. But you could have said that about both of these books. So I spent from mid-January till end of March, I was spending all my mornings working on these two books, and I was so happy that I thought I couldn't possibly give up philosophy. So that's what led me to go in philosophy. So then I went to Harvard, and I was really set up to meet Rawls because I just converted myself from a kind of decision theoretic quasi-utilitarian into some kind of Kantian. And I didn't realize that was what I was doing, but that was kind of where I was. But I took a couple of courses from Rawls and did an independent study with him once, and we got on very well, but I didn't really, wasn't writing on it then. But later on, beginning in about, I left in 66. I was only at Harvard for 3 years. And in the fall of 66, I started teaching in Princeton.
You were an instructor then?
I was an instructor at Princeton in 1966. And I there are two strands, we come to a fork here. There are two paths to go down. But the path having to do with roles was later on in about 1970, some friends, including my colleague there, Tom Nagel, and some other people formed a discussion group in political philosophy and philosophy of law that met monthly in New York or Cambridge. And Rawls was a member of that group. So for the next 5 years or so, I would see him once a month as part of this discussion group. So that's where I really, really came to know him better, although we kind of sort of bonded when I was a graduate student. But then going back to the teaching, so I was hired there sort of to teach logic, or that's what had impressed Banasseroff, who sort of basically recommended me to be hired. But a lot of people there wanted to teach logic, and there was less demand for teaching moral and political philosophy, and I was really very interested in it by then, so I did a lot, and found I had more ideas in that subject, so I kind of shifted over in treating it. And beginning then, for many years, I would teach some level of an introductory course or middle-level course in moral philosophy, and I always taught the groundwork, among other things. And I was always fascinated by the problem of trying to figure it out. You know, what really is the argument, right? And I went through many stages of trying to figure it out. So I always found it gripping as an interpretive puzzle. But as a matter of belief, I have to step back and say, well, but do I really believe it? And that my belief to it followed a sine curve from one year to the next, went up and down until finally it started going down and down and down and down. And now I'm well off of, I'm kind of an anti, anyway, not I'm not a Kantian of very much anymore. But it took me a long time to work through the reason I went down this path, to work through that original fascination with the groundwork. Well, two reasons mainly, three. So I went through a middle stage where I thought that Kant's, the formulations of the categorical imperative, for example, identify extremely appealing moral ideas, but that what Kant tries to do is to force those moral ideas into his metaphysical framework, and that really doesn't work. That is, these ideas are appealing because they present an appealing picture of our relations with other people, being fellow members of the kingdom of ends, or not treating people as mere means, but as ends in themselves. But he tries to derive them from an idea of how to realize our own freedom, in the special sense of freedom that emerges from his metaphysics. And that seemed to me both unconvincing on the one hand, but also not the right kind of, it was, as they say now, the wrong kind of reason. It had too much to do with me and not enough to do with my relations with other people. So that was a kind of a middle stage. But then the next stage was I decided that I didn't think that the ways of getting moral conclusions out of the categorical imperative really worked or were convincing in the right way. So the most convincing of them seemed to me to be the argument about the lying promise. But I think that if when you actually look at that argument, it's not that it doesn't work in its own terms, but it doesn't really deliver the kind of conclusion about the wrongfulness of making a promise. It derives a kind of contradiction, as Kant says, in the will of the person. That is, I both want it to be the case that my making a promise is seen as binding me in some way, but that doesn't make a connection with somehow the real seemed to me morally significant fact. So that was my main reason for. I said, first I gave up on it. First I didn't like the metaphysical ideas of freedom, but then I also thought that the structure that the categorical imperative tries to give to the fundamental principles of morality wasn't right. Now, of course, my idea of right and wrong as determined by what we could justify to others has a definite similarity to that. But as I said in my first book thinking about this thought. It's in Kantian terms, it's avowedly heteronomous. It has to do with my responsiveness to these reasons about other people, rather than the fact that I can. This is all that I can will. That's consistent with my independence from all the influences of my experience of value, for example. So. And the tradition following him, and indeed the tradition he's already acting in, places a great deal of emphasis on the idea of reason as a faculty, the human reason. And I don't find that a useful source of ideas. So capital R reason isn't very central for me, although I do think it's important that we are rational creatures, as we have the capacity to think about what to do, make decisions, provide reason, provide considerations that seem to us to support those decisions, and so on. But among other things, I don't think that there is a sharp distinction between reasoning, being a rational creature in that sense, and emotion, or subject to the passions, or whatever. I think that idea of the divided part of our faculties is a mistake, because acting out of an emotion is a matter of seeing a reason. If I'm angry at you and I act out of anger, that's because being angry at you involves seeing the fact that you won't like something as a reason to do it. there isn't, I think, a big difference between being rational in this very general sense of acting on what one sees, what one takes to be a reason, on the one hand, versus being moved by emotion or passion on the other hand. So I reject this idea, which is a really old idea in philosophy. But I've also come to think that the idea of a reason, that is a consideration that, as I say, counts in favor of something, is, you know, a plausible candidate to be the foundational element in normative thinking, in thinking about what to do, what you ought to do, both moral and non-moral. That's a hypothesis that I'm quite committed to, but I'm willing to think that it might turn out to be wrong. But I've been pursuing that line for quite a long time.
Where did you come to this idea first, and then this idea about what a reason is?
Well, when I was writing the first paper that was developed into What We Owe to Each Other, I had the idea of you know, principles that nobody could reasonably reject, and that involves the idea of a reason. We have some ground for objecting to this principle, and beyond that, I said in that original article, I was trying to explain why, not just what the content of morality is, but its appeal or authority, why people accept it, why people feel drawn to abide by its demands. And in that original article that I wrote in 1972, Contractualism and Utilitarianism, I said that, well, the motivational basis of morality lies in a desire to be able to justify ourselves to other people. Now, there was already a certain amount of debate about the reasons and desires, and so people ask me, well, do you think that people have any reason to follow the demands of morality if they don't happen to have this desire? Or does the reason depend on, does their having a reason to do what morality requires depend upon their happening to have, as a matter of their own psychology, this particular desire? There was quite a lot of debate about this. There's Bernard Williams' famous paper on internal and external reasons and other things. So for a long time, say roughly, for about 10 years, but between the time I wrote that paper and the early 90s, I took the position that I didn't have to answer that question for the purposes of carrying out my project, and that it was deeper philosophical waters than I was capable of wading into, and I could just avoid it. But by the early 90s, people were convincing me that in order I need to appeal to the idea of something being a good reason or reason, not simply to explain the motivational basis of morality, but to explain this idea of a principle being one that someone could reasonably reject. So I needed to take more of a stand on the question of whether reasons depended on pre-existing desires or not. And So sometime around 1994, I think, 93 or 94, I decided I have to do this. So I spent a few weeks reading Williams's paper, critiques of Williams' responses, and so on. And I felt that I was being intellectually whipsawed, that is, drawn back and forth. I would read one thing and I'd be sort of convinced by that, and then I'd read something on the opposite side and I would be drawn in that, and I just was at sea. So one Sunday I said to myself, I've got to pull up my socks and get a grip on myself or something. So on Monday I'm going to go out to my study and write a confession to myself about what I actually think. So I'll relieve myself of the pressure of commitment. I'm not writing a draft chapter of my book. I'm not writing something I'm going to publish. But I just have to somehow come down on one side or the other and be honest with myself about what I think about this. So that was a Sunday. And if you'd asked me on Sunday afternoon to predict what I was going to say, I would have said, well, what I'm going to say is that in many cases, many garden variety cases, people have reason to do things because doing them will satisfy some desire they have. That's a very common case. But there are other cases, such as maybe my reason not to murder somebody or to steal somebody's car, whatever. I have reason to do them that aren't contingent on my having certain desires. If you'd asked me to place a bet, you know, $50, $100, I would have been happy to take the bet. So Monday morning I went out and I started working, and by Tuesday I'd entirely convinced myself that the idea of a reason is a consideration that counts in favor of something, and reasons never depend on desires. It's simply a mistake, because having a desire, as I said, involves seeing something as a reason. So when we have a desire to do something, it's the consideration that's actually providing us with the reason, and the desire is just our awareness or our perception of that fact. I was as surprised as somebody else might have been that this was my conclusion. But that was how many years ago? 20 some odd years, or 20, 30 years ago. And as the years have gone by, I've just become more and more and more and more convinced that that's right. Now, a lot of things I've said, like we'll talk this afternoon about justifiability to other people, I have worries about whether what I said about that actually works. But this is one feature, for some reason, that as the years go by, I just become more and more dug into that position. And that's related to my relation to Kant, as I'm sure that was part of your point in asking the question. I didn't really think very much about Kant's theory as a general theory of practical reasoning in those early years, but since coming to Harvard and then hiring my colleague Christine Korsgaard, I got exposed to real hardcore Kantianism. Then I realized there was a bigger gulf there as between genuine realism about reasons and a Kantian idea that reasons are, as it were, creatures of the will in some very, very general sense. And I've never been, the idea that that's what Kantianism was would sort of seal the deal as far as my not being a Kantian. But I hadn't foreseen that when I got into the business. After I had underwent this change of mind about reasons, then the book, What We Owe to Each Other, took a different structure than it had before. So there was a chapter on reasons in the beginning where I defended this, and then a chapter on value where I tried to explain value in terms of reasons in this sense, and then a chapter on well-being where I tried to explain well-being in terms of value and reasons. And then finally in chapters 4 and 5, the theory of the morality of right and wrong, of that actions are wrong if they, any principle that permitted them is one that could be reasonably rejected. And then there are further chapters on responsibility and promises and relativism. And I've continued to be really entirely at home with the first three chapters and the last three chapters. The two in the middle, I still am extremely attracted to contractualism. And when I start thinking, for example, we were talking yesterday about about inequality, and my thinking about why is inequality objectionable very much gravitates toward the idea of what reasons do people have to object to principles that generate or license inequality. So I really am not out of that out of that groove. But the worry is about how to formulate the presentation of considerations that count for or against rejecting principles. I limited it very severely in that book to what I called personal reasons, the way in which my life would be affected if people in general abided by a certain principle and I had to abide by it as well, and the reasonableness of rejecting a principle based on how I'm affected by it was to be settled by comparing the strength of my reasons for objecting to the strength of the reasons that other individuals who are affected in similar ways have for wanting there to be a principle of that kind. And I'm you know, concerned about how to formulate that comparison. That's the main worry. I also worry a little bit about ambiguities in the idea of justifiability. The idea that morality has to do with justifiability to others is is something lots of people find appealing. It's to some degree in Habermas, it's in Axel Honneth, and many other people, which I take as a sign that that I'm somehow on the right track. Right, there are a lot of other people who think that as well. I think that I was a little bit. That I used the idea of justifiability in multiple senses without fully realizing I was doing it, but I don't think that's a reason to give up the view. But there is a question about whether the idea of reasonable rejection can be the whole thing about morality, but also whether it needs to have some normative foundation, some richer normative foundation for describing the kinds of reasons we have and the process that we go through in deciding whether a consideration is a sufficient reason for rejecting a principle. Of course, you could keep the idea of justifiability to others and then have some independent idea of right and wrong and say, well, this independent idea of right and wrong is the standard, and so it's the right standard. Therefore, if you've acted in accordance with that standard, then you can justify your action to others. But that just exports all the content into something else. So I don't there's the worry that you will lose the content of the view if you put too much independent structure into the idea of the terms of justification and what's a good justification and what's not a good justification. But I do think that maybe I was too abstemious or constrained in the particular assumptions I made about how to characterize reasons and estimate their strength. I've been thinking about issues of identity because they're very much in the air. Freedom of expression was my first interest in political thought. First, well, as we were saying earlier, I don't know whether I want to write on that because, again, it's something people care a great deal about, and I'm a little bit skeptical of the notion. But the question is, are there cases in which there's something properly called a fact about my identity that determines what I have reason to do or makes is one of the important considerations? And there certainly are such cases. The clearest cases are so-called ascriptive identity, the fact that other people see some feature of me, they may call it my race or something, as an important reason for treating me differently than other people. That's a social fact that I have to take account of in deciding, am I going to try to just accept that? Am I going to try to pass as a person who's not of that character? Am I going to make common cause with others who are similarly categorized to try to do something about it? So that's a very important fact. But that idea of identity, so to speak, is entirely something that's created by other people. And it isn't some deep fact about me. It might be that maybe race is an independent fact about me, but most people whom I read on the subject think that that's not really, really true. It really, as it were, comes from them, and the importance it has for me comes entirely from the importance it has for somebody else. And I may think that they're completely crazy in assigning it that importance, but the importance it has for me doesn't depend on the validity of their reasons for thinking it important. It just depends on that actual social fact. So one of the interesting questions is, are there facts that are more properly called identity because they start with facts about me that in themselves are reasons for me to do something. And I'm not sure. I try to go through cases and kind of experiment about whether there are. Many people believe that there are, and so I think it's an interesting question how that works. Sartre famously pointed out, and I'm totally convinced, that in many cases references to identity are what he called bad faith. I'm just avoiding the fact that I had to choose to be, if do I have a reason to do something because I'm a philosopher? And the answer is, well, that would depend on my actually having a reason to be a philosopher and to continue to be a philosopher and so on. And bad faith would, one form of bad faith would be to, as it were, evade the need to think about or answer that question and just take it as a brute fact that I'm a philosopher, so I have a reason to do what philosophers do. I think Sartre was just totally right about that. And so the interesting question is whether there are facts that are more facts about me than these ascriptive facts. Maybe sometimes facts about my heritage are important reasons for me, and that may well be true. And the interesting question is what do things have to be like in order for that to be so? Some heritages might be ones that I should leave behind. It's not just a fact about me, but it's a fact about me having the good fortune to have been born into the opportunity to participate in something that would be rather more like being a philosopher. The question I find interesting is whether there are things that don't, that can't be, not exactly explained away, but put into a different, either made to depend on independent value or made to depend on independent social fact. And that seems to me an interesting question. I don't know the answer, but I'm toying, reading around about it in various literature.